Welcome back to Highly Respected. I'm your host, Scott Greer. Today, I'm joined by Myth of the 20th Century podcast co-host and American Sun writer, Hank Oslo, not Hans Lander today. We got somebody new. Hank, how are you doing?
I'm doing fantastic.
That's great. You know, we have a big fan of the show. He's disappeared a while back. I think he went by the name Ironic Satire. We've been trying to reach out to him. All we know is that he's a huge fan of Myth of the 20th Century and of Highly Respected. But, you know, he's really disappeared. But if you stay quiet and you listen closely, you can hear off in the distance, "I'm white, by the way." So, Ironic Satire, if you're out there, give us a shout out. But, you know, we've got a lot to discuss today. And Hank wrote a terrific article for the American Sun last week about all the upcoming election craziness that we may witness. And obviously, if you're paying attention to the news, you're already seeing a lot of crazy stuff happening. So, Hank, why don't you explain to us what we may see come November in terms of, you know, Democrats trying to influence the election, you know, riots, possible the right wing getting involved. What do you see may happen in the next month or so?
A slow motion nightmare that rapidly devolves into a fast motion nightmare and then kind of slows down, but just to lull you into a false sense of security so you can think you're waking up. It's another nightmare.
Yeah.
that's the metaphysical construct that we find ourselves in. But no, on a more serious note, everybody agrees that this is going to be a complete disaster. The two sides, implying there are only two sides here, but the Trump campaign and the kind of broader Democratic coalition have been preparing their respective constituencies and their respective power bases for a long, drawn-out struggle that is sort of ongoing at the moment as we discover more and more interesting factoids about early voting, mail-in voting, ballots being mailed willy-nilly without too much accounting, and then how that hashes out in the inevitable after election day shenanigans, as we discover that we may not know the results for months, and every attempt is made to attempt to bring in boxes of ballots, you know, slips of paper with Orange Man Bad written on them. It's like, you know, it's metaphysically an anti-Trump vote. We'll count that. Yeah. And as that winds its way through courts that are fundamentally ill-equipped in order to make these fundamentally political determinations, things rapidly start to look like they're going to get either post-political or extremely political, depending on how you look at it.
Yeah, and there's already groups, you know, there's a coalition of MoveOn.org, Color of Change, American Federation of Teachers, creating a group called the Fight Back Table, where they're preparing for what may happen in a contested election. They have a ton of crazy ideas, even calling for the West Coast to possibly threaten secession if Trump is elected, and calling for, you know, mass street violence and mass urban turmoil. Responses. And I think everyone can agree that both sides are, depending on the result, is that one side is just not going to accept the result. And there's already been mainstream commentators saying that the healthiest thing for our democracy is if Joe Biden wins in a blowout, even though there are some polls showing him like 14 and 16 points ahead right now. I think most people realize that it's not that kind of blowout race. Everywhere you look,
and frankly, that's an ideal scenario for me. I would hope that on election night, you know, having counted, and in a lot of states, you know, it's not always the case that first you cast the votes that are cast on election day, and then you record all of the mail-in ballots. That's historically been the case in ones that were not as mail-in heavy as this election is going to be. You would have, you know, ballots arriving late that were cast around election day. But in the current situation, I mean, if you start with the mail-in ballots, which I don't think there's anything in election law in a lot of places that precludes that, I want to see like Soviet style. Oh, yeah, Joe Biden has 98% of the vote with 200% turnout, just really to make it clear exactly what's happening. as opposed to, yeah, well, you know, in a squeaker, he just happens to win by 10 votes.
Yeah, we've already witnessed that within, you know, urban areas such as Philadelphia has been a notorious offender of this, and that there's like astronomically high turnout in these areas. And then you're like, I don't think a lot of these people are voting. I think a lot of them are not allowed to vote, but somehow they're all going out and voting for, you know, the Democratic candidate, and there's record turnout. And there's down the line voting for Democrats. And we're even seeing that in Minneapolis, you know, with the story of Ilhan Omar's involvement in ballot harvesting, which they're now trying to say, oh, it's dubious, it's Project Veritas, you can't trust that. And it seems pretty clear evidence that, you know, these dumb Somalis are going around collecting like hundreds of ballots in their vehicle and driving them off to, you know, the election authorities. And Minnesota is the battleground state. So this ballot harvesting and electoral fraud could very well, you know, shift the election. What if Minnesota is
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
If you set a system up to specifically allow a thing to happen, it's because you want that thing to happen. Like this is not some obscure voodoo that we just don't know how to run elections. It's impossible. Every country, even like Iraq and Mexico, manage elections with far higher levels of just physical security than the United States does. Like universal voter ID, dip your damn finger in the ink so that you can't show up to a different polling site. These are effectively zero cost measures, and they're not imposed because the point is not to impose them so that they can be circumvented.
Yeah, exactly.
The fundamental problem with mail-in ballots like this is that, you know, it's like if you run a counterfeiting operation, you can look at the bill and you can be like, okay, well, this one maybe is counterfeit, so like this isn't valid currency. If you actually break into the mint and you just start hammering out $100 bills at 1 a.m., you're not counterfeiting anymore. You're just printing currency. And a lot of these ballots, it's not that they're in some sense fake ballots. They're physically valid. They follow the rules of this must be counted, but they're just fundamentally illegitimate. So when you get a stack of these things that were procured through illegal means, you know, you have people receiving four or five ballots. You have people receiving ballots that aren't addressed to them, other people not receiving any at all. Once these things start filtering into the system, there's absolutely no way to separate out the ones that were cast in accordance with what elections are theoretically for, as opposed to the ones that were conjured up out of thin air. And at that point, you're forced to regress to these kind of bailout scenarios where you have a vote count where you know some portion of these votes are absolutely fraudulent. You don't know which ones. There's no procedure to do a do-over, but you do have all of these kind of obscure little provisions of various state and national laws where at certain points you start to talk about the legislature stepping in. In some states, you have the possibility that you have multiple slates of electors being sent. And according to the congressional procedures for counting these things, they go with the ones that the governor blesses. So it's omni shambles all the way down. Like you can have a place with a divided state House and Senate with a governor from one party or the other, a completely fraudulent election. Everybody's just trying to send electors by fiat. And then you also have the United States Congress, which requires cooperation between the House of Representatives and the federal Senate in order to actually count these things. So if there are legitimate disputes about either, you know, from the Republican perspective about voter fraud or these excess ballots being sent hither and yon, or on the Democratic side about my voter suppression and my culture of fear, there will be incredible pressure at every possible veto point in this process to gum up the works or to jam things through, depending on who happens to be ahead. And some of these kind of mechanical procedures, there are nightmare scenarios where, you know, you imagine the quote unquote Brooks Brothers riot in 2000 in Florida, where one side determined, hey, if we're ahead and there's a recount going on that's putting us further behind, you stop the counting. How do you stop the counting? You make them physically unable to perform the counting so that the number stays the same. Like, you can kind of choose your own adventure there, but it's really not hard to imagine some fairly nasty things happening once people kind of internalize that fact.
Yeah, and I think we've already seen the level of street violence that can be marshaled by the left in order to get what they want. And you could very well see if there's a, you know, in a place where there is a still Republican control, I think, out of all the battleground states, I mean, there is Florida. Florida hasn't really witnessed that much violence this year, and compared to other states, it's been mainly in the Midwest. I think Wisconsin still has a Republican-controlled state legislature, but it's a Democratic governor. I may be mistaken on that. And a lot of other places, I know in Minnesota, of course, it's Democratic-controlled legislature and governor. I believe that's the case in Pennsylvania.
They're split, Michigan. Actually.
It's in Minnesota, it's split, or in Pennsylvania. Yeah.
In Minnesota, it's split. I'm not familiar with Pennsylvania. At one point, I had a nice spreadsheet tracking some of this stuff, but then I determined that probably nothing matters.
Well, I think in a lot of cases, it's going to be the governor who chooses. And you really, and well, judging by and how...
Even more obscure, like, you know, if you can name your state secretary of state, raise your hand. Yeah, I mean, you have a lot of these states that have divided legislatures, or a division between the governor and the legislature, or, you know, these obscure bodies like the state secretary of state, who usually kind of has the pro forma responsibility, usually pro forma, of signing off on the final election results. You have state electoral commissions in some areas. You have county electoral commissions that certify their individual results. It's really kind of the formalisms here, because they have never been exercised. They're perceived rightly by a lot of people as not legitimate if they are exercised. This was something that was discussed in 2000 in Florida, that the state legislature could just by fiat award the state's electoral votes to George W. Bush. And people were, you know, screaming even at the contemplation of that course of action, you know, for fairly good reasons. If you're told that there's one set of rules, and then it's like, well, you know, by the way, like, there's this kind of not secret, but incredibly obscure provision by which we can do the opposite of that. People are going to be apprehensive about that possibility, even if there are kind of very good reasons, like, you know, verifiable cases of people showing up with buckets full of ballots fresh for the counting. It's going to lead to some disturbances, and especially when those disturbances are cultivated, because there's kind of an ongoing strategy of tension and an ongoing, you know, kind of latent color revolution undertaken in the United States.
Yeah, and that's now a term that's gaining in popularity on the right in the same way the deep state did a few years ago. And now, and still as popular, is the term of color revolution. And now, and Democrats are trying to, and a lot of neocons and centrists and others are trying to downplay that this term color revolution is bad, that actually color revolutions are good and the CIA and State Department have nothing to do with it. I mean, as I've explained in past episodes, color revolution refers to a lot of the revolutions that were helped by the State Department and CIA in Eastern Europe in the 2000s, such as the Orange Revolution in 2004 in Ukraine. There was one in Georgia. I forget what color they used, but they used some color. And it's, they create the impression that it's a grassroots people just coming together to resist some evil tyrant or oppressive government. And they're just using peaceful change to bring about a government that happens to be pro-United States and allows American companies to come and pilfer their resources and is no longer and is hosting gay pride parades and all of this stuff. And they did it in Serbia, Ukraine, Georgia, a couple of other places. And there was actually a great thread that I shared on Twitter today, which I can't remember the user's name. He's got some strange username, but go and check my feed and you'll see it. I say really good thread on color revolutions and fifth generational warfare.
Yeah, and it's at Real Boy Physical. And that's his at. He's a good follow.
Yeah, Real Boy Physical. I'm sure I have a feeling this person is not going to like me highlighting their thread, but whatever. The thread goes into how the Maidan Revolution of 2014 in Ukraine is the central event of our time, and that what we used is both the U.S. and Russia were both using informational warfare, which is what fifth generation warfare, people shooting each other in the streets, is people writing news articles that uses dupe, are they setting up bots on the internet, on social media, and getting people out to go to places and to take over buildings. It's a con when Ukraine's president at the time refused to take a deal with the West and took one with Russia, and then gathered on the streets. Many using MLK-style protest methods of peaceful they're just sitting down, and soccer hooligans, I will not call it football on this American podcast, but who are out there also fighting with police and building up barricades and taking the fight to the streets otherwise. And this event still reverberates throughout a lot of what's going on in the world and our foreign policy decisions. And we're trying to do this now in Belarus. It's not working out quite the same way. And we had used a lot of these methods in the Middle East, which didn't quite work out how we intended, as is seen in the ongoing war in Syria, which I believe is entering its 10th year now, and in Libya and in Egypt, which I still question mark of how much role the State Department actually wanted that result. But we're now going to possibly see something of the same caliber here in the United States. And as I was referring to this left-wing group, which includes Color Change, MoveOn.org, and other prominent left-wing groups, as they are planning on doing something like this, where you will see these mass demonstrations on the scale that we've been seeing all summer. They're coming out and they're blocking, these institutes. They're taking over, institutions in the states. Say if they have a Republican governor and he's not giving them the result they want, they go and take over the state house or the governor's mansion, and they use, intimidation to get the result they want. And this will be backed by most Democratic lawmakers. I don't think you would see the same case with Republicans. Like if, Governor Whitmer was stealing the election from Trump, and then Trump mobilized his supporters to go out to the Michigan State House to do this, they would use overwhelming force against these boomers who went out there. You would maybe even see some of them getting shot if they were charging into the State House. I mean, yes, you saw that, in the anti-lockdown protests, a lot of these people charging in the State House, and a lot of them were armed. Very different scenario this time. And there's also been a radicalization in the public atmosphere since April, especially in the George Floyd protests. And I think there would be Governor Whitmer urging severe force, if not lethal force, against them. And you really couldn't use that. Well, if a Republican governor was sending out police to use batons and tear gas against them, you would be of course, the whole media would be outraged and demanding this person be arrested. And maybe that person would be. And you could see that in maybe Texas or Florida or other places where there's a primarily Republican-controlled state. And they know this is a powerful weapon, and they know that the media will be on the side of left-wing protesters. They know that certain authorities, such as we've seen in the Portland District Attorney, refusing to press charges against most of the rioters there, they know that they can do this, and a lot of the worst, most violent people out there can get away with anything, and they may get a citation for throwing a firebomb, but that's all they have to worry about. And I think this is the most likely scenario that we're going to see violence. I think this would be a very close election, and no matter if it's close, you're definitely going to see people out in the streets rioting on a scale in the same manner that we were seeing in June and throughout the summer. And I'm not sure what the Republican response will be. Do you know? Do you have an idea of what it might be, Hank?
I think that kind of depends on scenarios, and it also, frankly, depends on how hard Trump is willing to go in terms of contesting things. I think that his kind of initial instinct will be, "Oh, we'll just take it to the courts," which, you know, we've seen how well that has worked out for him, both in his personal capacity and in his governing capacity over the course of his term thus far. He does not have a particularly compliant judiciary, despite the number of judges that he's been able to appoint, just strictly due to the fact that every judge in the country feels themselves entitled to do things like issue nationwide injunctions. There's a lot of jurisdiction shopping. And so, I mean, if that is the sum total of his contesting of the election, I do not see that as being a very effective mechanism. Now, you could see him doing any spectrum of things, like some sort of ill-defined message to get out on the streets and make your voice heard, or, you know, whatever kind of flowery language you might interpret on top of that. I thought that his message during the debates to stand back and stand by, a lot of people on the left were like, "Oh God, he's got, you know, fry corpse just mustering the in the woods
Boys.
And he's bushes."
Out the base Latinos of the Proud Boys to go out and beat up libtards.
Right, but I mean, these are the kind of pronouncements that actually people do use those in order to coordinate action. So, I mean, ignoring that particular utterance, like even something fairly anodyne, like get out on the streets, I think that that will result in a lot of distributed coordination that, you know, I think a lot of people are under no illusions on either side that it's kind of a winner takes all type scenario. The left is very aware that if they win this election, like if Joe Biden is president in a year, then absolutely nothing that they did in order to get him into office will be prosecuted by anyone. And I think on the right, unfortunately, there's not that same level of explicit or implicit guarantee. But when the alternative is Kamala Harris going and, you know, swatting your family, that's, you know, a lot of things start to look attractive by comparison.
Yeah, and there's, of course, they're not going to prosecute any of the irregularities if Biden wins. And Biden, Kamala Harris has promised when she was running for president that she would prosecute Trump if they gain office. And this is very likely. It might not even come from the federal government, because I believe the some of the district attorneys in New York City are already eager to press charges against Trump for
you'll see
whatever.
Like 30 district attorneys, like literally the day after Election Day, regardless of the outcome. A lot of them will be like, "Well, I'm a good party man, and this is my opportunity to do good by the party." Like you'll have random PAs in Rhode Island being like, he ran a traffic light in 1998 and the statute of limitations isn't quite out, so we're going to need to issue a warrant.
Yeah, and they want to have that career. That would make their career if they want to become the New York governor, if they're like, "I'm the person to put away Donald Trump." And there's never been a time where, you know, there's been a prosecution of a former president. I mean, Gerald Ford rightly pardoned Richard Nixon because it was like, we cannot go through this this absolute catastrophe of prosecuting a president. This would be terrible for our country. We'll prosecute some of his underlings. That's what we'll move on, but we have to move on. Like, this is a spectacle our country cannot endure. That type of thinking no longer exists in our country. They are, as you said, there's going to be dozens of district attorneys who want to line up and prosecute Trump. And the Democratic administration is not going to care. I mean, I think there may be ways that Trump can pardon himself, but that only will protect him from federal crimes. It's going to happen on the state level. There's going to be a sore winner mindset with this country. I mean, we already have people who are calling for truth and reconciliation commissions. Very prominent people such as Chris Hayes, who wanted this, and Bill Kristol agreed, but he doesn't want a reconciliation. He just wants a truth commission. I guess we're all thrown into prison camps and learn about how the Iraq war was the right thing to do. And maybe Chobani, or was the idiot that they got to run Iraq that nobody knew. They had some idiot that they found, and they're like, we're going to have this person. It's like Chobani or some Iraqi name. And yeah. I guess they can dig him up and help him run the re-education
camp. I'm in Chalabi.
Chalabi. He might be dead now, though. You know, they're going to find
nice. It's just chilling in Northern Virginia somewhere, I'm sure.
Yeah, being like, Trump is a threat to our democracy. He is
he did die.
Yeah, where's the civility and decency? And this is the type of rhetoric we're going to see. And they're really going to want to do this. They weren't going to not just want prosecutions of Trump. They're going to want prosecutions of all his top supporters. They're going to want to go after news outlets. Like, you could definitely see an investigation of Breitbart. Even much less so any publication that's accused of being white nationalist. You know, they're definitely going to go after these outlets. Any group that is right wing and has a 501c3, they're going to try to take away their nonprofit status. They're really going to go hard if they win. And people will be like, well, Biden promises to restore unity and civility. We're just pressing the rewind button to 2014. And it's like, yeah, this guy's senile. He doesn't remember 2014. He's going to like Kamala and our Kamala. Yeah. I'm trying to get her name right. I always try to make sure that it is, but it doesn't.
I always microaggress mostly because I can only remember so many names.
Just call her Kamala. I mean, that's what Barack Obama called her. So you might as well say Kamala. Yeah,
that's how I roll.
But that's who the people are going to be prosecuting this. They're going to be so eager to do this. And Trump really can't do this, even though, you know, he notices that the FBI launched a coup against him, against his administration. And this was backed by the Obama administration. And he can't do anything about it because the Department of Justice is full of shit libs, and Barr knows this, and Barr is, you know, having to play a delicate balance. Yes, everyone can say, like, well, Barr should do more in arrest. Yes, that is true. But you also have to realize that these institutions, even if they're led by people who are good, like Bill Barr or Trump, that they're full of shit libs who don't want to do this, and they're going to revolt, and they're going to do as much as possible to make life difficult for the people who are trying to do good stuff. And that is more of a reason why we need a clean house in these places, but that's going to have to take with a second term. And there's a strong likelihood that even if Trump wins a second term, he will still not be able to prosecute Comey and Lisa Page and all these other heinous people who really should be behind bars for what they did. He's like hands are tied just by the institutional framework that we're given.
Frankly, as a deterrent effect, you know, coming in on day one and having a core group of like 20 hatchet men who go and clean house, that has a certain amount of deterrent effect. But it's like, well, after 4 years, if the president happens to win election and your coup is kind of unsuccessful, then the people who had obvious criminal conduct that they wrote down might get prosecuted, regardless of whether they actually get convicted. That's not exactly something that prevents future shenanigans, and it's not something that actually removes this particular political coalition from their current positions of power and responsibility. You really do need like Stalin-esque purges if you're going to seize control of these institutions and run them in the interests of the American people.
Yeah, but unfortunately, I don't really see those types of people within the administration. There's a few who are going after, you know, career people, not necessarily within the deep state, but within more of the administrative state, like Department of Interior and HUD and places like that. But they're not necessarily, they want to go after the State Department. But in some ways, like Pompeo wants that evil State Department to remain because he's fully committed to the the global homo foreign policy of, you know, the past 20 years, 20 or 30 years. He's fully committed to that. And he wants to keep a lot of those shit lib bureaucrats around, even though, you know, he may have different priorities for them. And it's, and Barr is probably the closest one to Hatchet Man, but he realizes that his whole like staff is full of libs, and he doesn't really have people to replace them, or, you know, fellow allies to really target them and get rid of them. Maybe that might happen in the second term. We'll have to see. I think another thing that is important to note is, you know, I was getting at this earlier, is that when you talk about mobilizing the streets, one of the real downsides and weaknesses of the right in America is the inability to have these mass demonstrations on the level of a women's march or the Black Lives Matter marches that we're seeing in June. And some of this is due to the nature of conservatives, is that, you know, as even we were seeing with the anti-lockdown protests, a lot of them are older, skew older. They're not necessarily people who are going to want, you know, if you're in your 50s, you're not exactly seeking violent aggression out on the streets. There's a part of that, and they're just like, well, and when, even with the anti-lockdown protests, is a lot of these people were driven to desperation because they were small business owners. Are there people who were not, you know, wondering how they're going to make ends meet that month? And they went out and were very violent and aggressive. I wouldn't actually say violent, but aggressive and assertive against these lockdown orders, because that was really hurting them and that was hurting their economic bottom line. When it comes to something that is less tangible to them, say the, you know, the election, where it's not necessarily the economic bottom line that is in, you know, threatened, they may see, well, I really don't like that Biden is winning, but maybe I'll still be able to make a living. I don't know if I'll probably maybe still be able to afford rent, and I'm going to base these on economic considerations. So that's one reason that there is, and there is the fact that the media demonizes and hates right-wingers if they go out, no matter what cause they are. I mean, if you can compare the treatment of the anti-lockdown protesters to Black Lives Matter, you would have thought that, you know, the Fry Corps had just been reincarnated in America and were about to shoot Governor Whitmer during the lockdown protests, while these people who are throwing Molotov cocktails and burning down police departments and violently attacking innocent passerbys who merely didn't say Black Lives Matter, they were turned into nice little peaceful children who are, they're moms, the Portland moms. They're just so, we're wanting to protect kids. And most of them, of course, were childless women who've never had a child in their life. That's the type of treatment that there are. It's like, no matter what type of violence is coming from the left, they will ignore it or try to blame it on clandestine white supremacists.
That's big into the cake at this point. And that's one of the reasons why, like going out in the street in like a big huddle, wandering around shouting stuff, is not a strategy if you want a specific thing to happen. Like this sort of mass mobilization is designed to make an area ungovernable in order to present to whichever faction of the ruling elite you're trying to empower that, well, the current approach is not working, so you need to get rid of your current prime minister and put this other prime minister in charge. In the case of Ukraine, in the case of the United States in the 60s, like kind of the original color revolution, it's like, okay, well, you need to disempower these Southern Democrats. You need to stop catering to them, or like we can make these areas of the country effectively ungovernable. So that is not necessarily, it's not a good strategy for the right. Like you need to establish what your specific objective is, and then how many people you need in what place in order to accomplish that objective. So that's not to say that like you never physically go to a place and do a thing. You absolutely should. And I think that that will become increasingly necessary or advisable. You should find out things like where are your local polling stations, and then where are the votes actually physically counted? Because these are the sorts of areas where it's going to be important to do things like show up and prevent shenanigans. Like there was a whole controversy, I believe, in New York State about Trump poll watchers being effectively forbidden from accessing
facilities. I think it was Pennsylvania. Yeah. I think. Yeah, and there's videos of them. They're like, sorry, we're full. And they're like, what? I'm like, why? And they're like, sorry, you can't enter here. It's like, but I'm a poll watcher. It's like,
I mean, you talk about civil disobedience. It's like, well, if I can't enter, then nobody can enter. Like that's a thing that people can quite foreseeably intend on doing and have the ability to enforce with a minimal number of people. And in areas that are frankly a little bit too obscure to have mass media attention. So I mean, these are the sorts of micro scale distributed coordination that would need to happen in the event of a severely contested election, which I think is baked into the cake at this point. Not like we get a million guys and we sit out on the mall and we wave MAGA flags. Like that doesn't help you when the person that's screwing you is a local precinct captain in like some area of, some Detroit suburb.
Yeah. No, and I agree with that take. And the one thing is just a matter of whether they're going to organize or not. And the last point I would say that it harms a lot of these right-wing activism on the level that we've seen with the left is that the state is much more willing to come down harder on right-wingers than it is with left-wingers that we've seen on a nightly basis in Portland and other places where people are just let go. Meanwhile, if you drive through a crowd, you can face 8 years in jail, even though you're an innocent passer, motorist who was just trying to get home. If you disobey the mob, you can face jail time for that. And that's just the nature of the case. But I think even with this poll watcher and this election stuff, which is what the Brooks Brother riot was about in 2000, is that people were counting these ballots. And, you know, there was possible shenanigans going on and they just charged in and made sure that they couldn't do the shenanigans. And they were watching and observing and it disrupted the process in a manner that benefited the Republicans. So there should be stuff like that that is peaceful, largely follows the law and just engages.
Sufficiently peaceful.
Yeah. And then make sure that these people are being watched, that they're not being able to get away with this without anyone watching them or without any complaints. And they will, buckle if they see, 100 boomers outside, like demanding a fair election. And they're like, oh no, they know what we're doing. So I think there is a possibility that you could see this. I think already there's an awareness that people in Pennsylvania are doing weird stuff. Pennsylvania has a lot of diehard Trump supporters who will travel, an hour away to make sure that the votes are counted fairly and there's no shenanigans going on. So we definitely support that type of stuff. And it sends the message that they're not going to be able to get away with this. But it does say a lot about our democracy that we cannot accept that neither side is really going to accept the results. And a lot of people brought up the example of 1960 election where Kennedy's side likely used these electoral fraud to win in Illinois and Texas, which were states that he won by a very small margin. And there's likely ballot stuffing and harvesting and all this other stuff that, there's a lot of organized crime support for Kennedy in Illinois and other places. And also there was these political machines, both led by LBJ in Texas and Richard Daley in Chicago, that were able to help him and give them the extra boost. But Richard Nixon did not contest the election. The next day he called up Kennedy to concede the election, even though he could have challenged it in court and done all this. But there was still an idea that, well, I don't really like the result, but we're all Americans. We generally share the same values. And Richard Nixon and JFK were not that fundamentally different in how they campaigned. They mainly argued over who would spend more on defense and who would spend a little bit more on domestic programs. There was not that much difference between them. It was mainly a difference in style and personality that they were choosing. And there was a general gist that, well, we're still on the same team and the same Americans. You will never see that with Trump and Biden. I mean, if you looked at the presidential debate last week where Biden is calling him a racist and essentially saying he is fostering evil neo-Nazi terrorists to go out and kill innocent civilians, that does not indicate a mutual level of respect or a shared identity or shared sense of values or a shared purpose that they can just two get along and help rebuild this country. what you really had in the 1960s when we were a much more homogenous place. And, you know, we had the wave of good feeling from the Cold War that America is like, you know, the greatest country in the world, We're the superpower. We have these evil communists to beat. We cannot let, you know, a contested election get in the way of American power and give a gift to our enemies. You know, we don't really have that today. And, you know, there is a real delegitimization in American institutions that is only going to continue more and more. And we're going to see essentially every election from now on being on the same level as we've seen in 2016. And, you know, you have to think is that in 2016, the left did not accept the election results and the deep state did not accept the election results. There was a soft coup that occurred there. And we're going to continue to see this from now on in America. And yet they will still talk about our great democratic values and how only in places like Belarus and Russia are there election shenanigans. There's nothing like that in our country. And of course, we never meddle in other places. It's outrageous that any foreign country would meddle in our election. So this is the future of American democracy. I hope liberals love it. And the lie and delusions of Biden's campaign that we can return to some mythical, you know, pre-partisan era where everyone could sit down and have a drink and get along and pass legislation. It's never coming back. And every election from now on is going to be contested.
Yeah, Joe Biden is the hospice candidate in more ways than one. His job is to take the American population and make it nice and comfortable, play some, you know, some hits from 2012 and meanwhile, just kind of slide the pillow over the face and make sure that you never actually come out of that, that facility.
Yeah, no, I would agree with that. I would agree with that. And maybe they might be doing this to Trump. I mean, the COVID diagnosis of him and their reaction towards it is one of the most bizarre events that we've seen. And we've seen several bizarre events from 2016. But the president getting a deadly virus and the media's reaction towards it with spreading conspiracy theories that he doesn't actually have it, or clear depression and anger that he's recovering from it so quickly, or that he's taking a positive attitude. Journalists are demanding that he's like caught, like is deathly ill, giving no public address, and they want him to be at death's door. And being very panic and urging panic and fear among Americans. He came out with very basic responses like, look, I recovered from this. We shouldn't let it dominate our lives and shouldn't let fear, you know, ruin our great country. Instead, they're like, no, we need fear to ruin our great country. We need you to panic over this. This is the most deadly virus ever. You must wear a mask at all times, even when you go to the bathroom and take a shit. You must wear a mask. You shouldn't take the mask off at any point in your life. This is their argument about this. And, you know, this is something that you would have otherwise seen would have gained the president of the United States sympathy in any other time. But due to our, you know, polarization, the media covered it as something Trump should apologize for and that Trump should even die from because of just how much they hate him. Like, we're not living in a healthy democracy when our media institutions cheer on for the death of the president from a virus or say that you deserve it to to the representative of our nation. That's what the president is. So you expecting us to return back to even 2014, or really what they want to return back to is the Cold War era where, you know, Tip O'Neill and Ronald Reagan got together and they passed stuff and they didn't let partisanship divide them. And when you really look at all the bipartisan ideas that come out of Washington, such as more war, amnesty, you know, these horrible trade agreements that send our jobs overseas and help develop China, you're like, yeah, bipartisanship sucks. Like, there's never anything good that comes out of it, except for the crime bills of the 80s and 90s. But now the bipartisanship is that we want to free more criminals. Criminal justice reform is another terrible bipartisan idea. So when you look at Trump's COVID diagnosis, and, you know, maybe this is an attempted assassination attempt. Who knows? You know, you have to wonder.
Especially given everybody else that's now also come down with a diagnosis. It appears to be rampaging through the general staff of the various armed forces, as well as, like, you know, all of these highly kind of Trump-aligned portions of his staff and cabinet.
Yeah, like Stephen Miller just got announced as having it. So,
I mean, the fortunate thing is that although COVID, it may not be kind of like an earth shattering, giga plague or whatever. If you just look at the mortality rate by age bracket, there was like a 5% chance that Trump would have succumbed to COVID. That's about the same chance as if you just have somebody in the crowd with a revolver from, 20 feet away, blasting away in his general direction. So it was a serious thing. And it remains to be a serious thing because, we don't exactly know kind of what the progression is of the disease in his case. It's something that should not be minimized. And I think if he's smart, God, can you get a more perfect, like, hero's journey plot line on a silver platter? Like, is literally the part where the hero is supposed to descend into Hades and conquer death and come back out the other side. That's just what this is. Your brain might not recognize it, but your mind recognizes it. There's a reason why these things are tropes. So if he's smart, he'll try to concretize that and rely on the baying of the media that they refuse to follow his narrative, where he's only bad things, just a constant stream, just Voldemort, Satan.
Yeah, and he even did that with his comeback video, where he's this dramatic return from the helicopter. He walks on, he takes off his mask, and he waves to the crowd or whoever's gathered before him, and he's waving to the cameras. Of course, the media was apoplectic over it. They're like, he's gasping. He's actually much sicker. How dare he show himself, put a positive face on this? He must go to bed and he must keep that mask on and he has to die. And then they, of course, were saying that it's a Mussolini moment because if you ever get on a balcony, apparently that's a fascism. And then even people who were like saying badass, it's a Mussolini moment. All the journalists were like, don't tell him how it ends. Nick Fuentes' tweet, celebrating it as a Mussolini moment. All these journalists then lied and pretend they weren't the ones making the comparisons. It was like, hey, don't tell him what happens to Mussolini. It's not good. And it's like, okay, yeah, it's like he wasn't hung off a balcony. Everyone knows what happens to Mussolini. And journalists generally have no historical base of knowledge. And all they know is Mussolini bad and he got killed and he was hung upside down when he was killed. And yeah, but Nick Fuentes and other right wingers weren't the ones making the initial Mussolini comparisons. It was the media who, anytime that there's a display of strength or virility or use of powerful staging, they're just like, this is a fascism. How dare we have a fascism?
Or a crowd liking their rulers as opposed to some bland technocratic screw job. Like there's no less Mussolini like figure than Andrew Cuomo or Bill de Blasio or Governor Whitmer. Like these are not people who are going to be saluting from balconies anytime soon, because they'd probably be pelted with tomatoes from the crowd.
Yeah, exactly. And there's this, and they really want the Biden rallies, which is like eight people in an auditorium. They're in their little circles. They have their mask on. They're sitting down. They're sitting there like little school children in detention, and they're gagged with their mask, and they're just sitting there, and they're obeying, for some reason Biden, who's like 20 feet away from them. Probably even more, and he has his mask on and he's just talking along, and it's boring, dull, and utterly repressive. And this is what we're supposed to have. It's not supposed to have the enthusiastic crowds for Trump, because that's a fascism. You can't have that. You can't have crowds waving the American flag and acting excited for their leader. They have to be they're put in their little corner with their little circle, their mask on. They're ready to be little good kids, and they're gonna ready to follow the teacher. And even though the teacher's gonna bore them because he's senile and can't remember what he had for breakfast, you know, this is what we want for democracy. It cannot be exciting because it cannot be exciting. It cannot be empowering. It cannot display masculine or virile traits. It has to be boring, dull, and something that is set up by one of these horrible, awful school teachers who wants to have complete authority and loves finding out and snitching on the people who are not wearing masks in their neighborhood as they're walking their dog. That's what politics is supposed to be. Anything else is a fascism. And by the way, I'm saying is a fascism rather than is fascism, because all these stupid Redditors and liberals are always like, that's a white supremacy. That's a racism. For whatever reason, they always like to add.
Get a heck of a fascist Reno.
That's what we can't allow. But it looks like Trump is recovering. The one thing I wonder is how this will affect him in the polls. I mean, the polls this week are not looking good. There's, of course, the CNN poll I was alluding to earlier showing him Biden with a 16-point lead. I think there was one that came out today that shows Biden with a 12-point lead. It's already too – people want to, oh, it's over. It's too early. I mean, you have to realize is that the Access Hollywood tape came out a month before the 2016 election. And everyone was like, this is over, race is done. All half the Republican Party abandoned Trump and were disavowing him and saying they couldn't look their daughter in her face if they kept supporting Trump. And then 3 weeks later, they went back to supporting Trump. So you can't say right now what the poll numbers is. It is curious whether this will help him or not. I'm not quite sure yet, because I mean, when we're seeing the recent polls as saying, you know, we're not seeing necessarily the bump, but maybe when he goes on the rallies and he's like, you know, fully recovered, fully healthy, and he's like saying, like, I went through COVID, I'm now healthy, I recovered, we can't let fear ruin our lives. Maybe that might be a powerful message going forward. We'll have to see.
I think that the polls on kind of a minute by minute basis, I do not use them as part of my decision-making process, just because at this point, I think that the decision is much more about kind of each side's turnouts of their marginal voters than some kind of ephemeral, undecided, like moderate centrist who just wishes, you know, why can't they both be president? Like that... that person, I don't think really exists, or if they do exist, they're just going to coin flip based on what they had for lunch when they went into the voting booth that morning.
I think there is a couple of older people who are like that. I do know.
Yeah, but there's not a lot of them.
There's not much more of them.
Like, you can try to put these kind of dramatic moments that stick in their mind for when they collapse to one of these quantum states, but they're not somebody that forms a constituency that you can reach out to and be like, look, I delivered X, Y, and Z for you. That's why during the debates, it was so interesting that both sides were kind of doing that core reach out to their base. Trump wasted, I mean, not wasted, he spent like 5 minutes talking about the number of judges that he had appointed to various federal courts with one more Supreme Court justice on the way. That's not something that your moderate, centrist, undivided person cares about. That's something that's just pure red meat for his already existing constituency to actually turn out to the polls, bring a friend or two, and give him four more years so he can keep delivering the red meat that only seems to be on the menu during election years.
Yeah, and I think it is actually right. You cannot necessarily trust the polls right now. And I think the polls are going to be far off, or more off this time than they were in 2016, because we don't know what electorate's going to show up on election day, or how these like mail-in ballots are going to come out. I think there's going to be even lower black turnout now. And also, if people are really frightened of coronavirus come election day, that helps Republicans more than Democrats. So we don't necessarily know what the turnout is going to look like. And I do think there is this secret Trump voter phenomenon where people are talking on the polls, and a lot of older people are probably more fearful of this. When I heard older relatives talking about people calling them on the phone about polls, they would get really nervous and frightened. They're like, I don't know what they would just like say whatever they thought would be the correct answer, as they think that
who's running this year?
Yeah.
Is it that nice black man again?
Yeah. And I think when you see with like Trump's is underwater with seniors, I think it is COVID is having an effect on them. But probably not to the effect that the polls are showing, where it's like Biden is leading among seniors. It's like, I don't think that's the case. I don't think that, and we're definitely not going to see that on election day. So you shouldn't necessarily trust the polls, as a lot of people, as most Trump supporters are all about in 2016. The funny thing is the polls weren't, statewide polls were off, but the national polls weren't that far off in 2016. The RCP average had Hillary Clinton like 3 points and some change ahead of Trump, and she won the popular vote by like 2.3% or something like that. So it wasn't that far off. The thing is, the statewide polls, they didn't see this in Wisconsin. I think they had Hillary Clinton like 8 points ahead in Wisconsin and several other battleground states that Trump ultimately won. And I think they're going to be more skewed and more off just because the turnout is such a huge question mark this year. And I think also pollsters and journalists themselves are trying to talk themselves into believing that Trump can't win. And they want to comfort themselves with these overwhelming poll figures to be like, calm down. We only have a few more weeks of Trump. He's going to be gone forever. We're going to lock him up when he's out of power. They really want to believe themselves. I mean, you look at any of the journalist feeds, they are insistent that the polls are 100% correct this time. You cannot doubt them. Biden is cruising to an easy victory. It's going to be a blowout. They were saying the same thing in 2016. So I don't necessarily want to say that like it's guaranteed for Trump right now. A lot of things, it doesn't look as great now, but you have to look at what was happening in 2016, a month before the election. Access Hollywood tape looked a lot worse than Trump's current situation. So maintain hope. And on that note, I think we're going to move to reader questions, which this reader questions from the highly respected Patreon. This time it is not a politics question. It's actually a culture question. And it's asking for my opinion about high culture that we should all appreciate. This question comes from JP, and he asks, Scott, what is your favorite metal album of the year? Well, I'm glad somebody is finally asking me important questions. I would say from stuff I've listened to, the best albums I've listened to is there's this Czech black metal band called Cult of Fire, which has Hindu themes. And they released two separate albums, but it's more like a double album release. The two albums are called Moksha and Nirvana. It's very good. I urge people who enjoy black metal to check it out. Other good metal albums that I've listened to, Black Magic SS, Rainbow Knights. They combine psychedelic with black metal. It's actually a very good album. I urge people to check that out. And I recently listened to an album from this band from Portland called Uada, and they have a new album out called Jin. It's also black metal, more melodic black metal in the style of Dissection. Also very good. Hank, do you have any favorite metal albums of the year? I'm not sure if you
listen of the year. I think I'm a few years older than you, Scott. So I listen to the classics. I just do what my feed tells me to on YouTube.
That's I'm very much the same. YouTube recommendations has been giving a lot of good new albums. And if there's ever a new like album premiere on there, it will send me the recommendation. You know, I have to thank you, Big Tech Algorithm, for letting me find more black metal. I was actually very much the same. When I was in high school, I was not listening to many of the new releases. I stuck with the metal canon, which, if people are not familiar with heavy metal canon, pretty much all the great albums were released in the 80s and early 90s. And then, like, sometime after 95, there's a steep decline in quality, with the exception of black metal. Black metal didn't really have a time period where, you know, it had a time period where all the major classic albums released, but there was still a maintaining of quality, and there wasn't necessarily dependence on the big independent labels encouraging these bands, as it was in the case with death metal and thrash metal, which there was a major decline in the 90s and those albums, because a lot of those bands were dependent on the big independent labels. And then once they were dropped from their label, they're like, okay, well, we're splitting up. So albums got worse in that regard. But when I was in high school, I didn't really listen to many new releases. But as an adult, thanks to YouTube recommendations and other recommendations from other people, I'm listening to more new stuff. So on a final note, I urge listeners to check out those albums. And Hank, we're out of time, but I know you've got a lot of things to shill. So where can people find your work and support you?
I think theamericansun.com is the best place to kind of find up-to-date commentary. Otherwise, if you want to listen to the podcast, myth20c.com.
All right, great. And thanks for coming on. Hopefully we'll get all the Myth of the 20th Century hosts on eventually. We can mark that off the checklist, the highly respected checklist. And maybe we'll hear from Ironic Satire. You know, he's a person of mystery. So maybe he'll rise up, you know, and shout, "I'm white," by the way, rather than whispering it out in the distance. So hopefully we'll have that happen. But anyway, thanks for coming on again. We really appreciate it. And we have to have you on again soon.
Thanks a bunch, Scott.
You're welcome. And until next time, stay respected.